Today is June the 16th, 2006, and we are with Stella Sullivan, who has a treasure trove of clippings and information and all kinds of yummy goodies for future historians to have a look at. But today we're going to talk to Stella and ask her to think back and remember Houston in the 50s and 60s, what it was like, what it was like to be here as an artist, how she got started as an artist. And Stella, if you knew as a little girl you were an artist, or what pushed you forward. And I'm just going to set this down here and you can start.
Okay. I knew from the time I was four, at least, that I was going to be an artist, and I considered myself an artist then. And I never had very much formal training when I was young, but I did get introduced to people with my mother and all, and she would take me to visit the artist, and then I don't know whether she was taking me to see who might be a good teacher for me, you know. And I ended up taking classes from McNeil Davidson. She taught a lot of the important artists in town. And
and how old were you when you started?
I don't know, about 8 or 10, somewhere in there.
Fine. Yeah.
And then later I went into the museum school and studied, had at least one class, maybe one semester or something, with Mr. Plover on about this same age. And then again, in high school, I studied with him. When I was taking these classes in high school, Jack Flanagan was in the class, and this was about the time he won the purchase prize for the still life painting. He's on the list, you know, at the museum, the Houston Artist Show. And I don't remember if that was, again, just 1 year, probably. And when I went to Rice, I took architecture to get the art classes.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in architecture, of course, because my father and my brother and an uncle were all architects. My father's a prominent architect here. And I studied with Mr. Chilman,
mm-hmm.
watercolor and drawing, freehand drawing, and art history. Loved the art history. I had 5 years of that. And 1 year, I think it was Mr. Watkin, who, or one semester anyway, but the rest of it was Mr. Chilman. And I thought that was a great background for what I did later.
Well, now, were you going over to the museum school and studying while you were at, or was this at Rice? He was teaching at Rice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether the teaching at Rice was the main thing, I think, and the museum was. Anyway. My parents used to take me to all the openings at the museum when I was little, and that's where I first remember seeing Gertrude Levy. And we didn't get to know each other then, particularly or anything. I just was aware of her. And
because her mother was taking her, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she also was a friend of one of my mother's real good friends.
Well, you know, studying with Mr. Chilman at Rice, mm-hmm. and the watercolors and all that, and then... Then, did you graduate from Rice,
mm-hmm.
and then you went on to Cranbrook, or what?
Eventually. I worked in my father's office off and on,
mm-hmm.
for a few years, and I saved up my money and went back to art school 1 year, because Leela had been going and insisted I would join the classes with her, you know, and her.
Yeah.
And so I finally did, and just loved it, you know.
Now, where were these classes?
In the museum.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the African gold stuff is, I think. You know that
now?
Mm-hmm. That all across that side upstairs was where the art classes were. It was sort of one big room and had maybe a couple of partitions or something, but I think they took those away eventually. But I studied with Miss Euler, gave one class. Lowell taught the painting classes, and he was just great. I got a lot out of him. He was a lot of entertainment and fun and jokes and all that, but he was a good critic too. Where's one of my...
Well, what was Ruth Euler like?
She was wonderful. Oh, I was going to tell you about that. I got off on McNeil Davidson. Mother took me over to Grace Spalding John's studio, and I met Miss Euler and Grace, and we had tea or something like that, and I remember this day that they were being there, and I think she had posed for that painting that the museum has now, you know. And I saw a fair amount of Grace over the years. And another time, Mother took me by Mrs. Cherry's house where mm-hmm. she was having a portrait class out of doors. It was strange, you know, to be doing portraiture outside. But, I mean, looking back on it, I was like, so.
Well, who was giving the class? Mrs. Cherry?
Mrs. Cherry.
Uh-huh.
And I remember there was a boy, young man. I think he was standing or seated on a stool or something like that. Anyway, it wasn't sitting down. And he finally bought him all apart. Had a bright blue shirt on. And the house was there.
Well, Emma Richardson Cherry, what was she like?
I don't know. I just remember that one
time.
Yeah, but I do remember Miss Euler off and on. And, of course, by the time I did go back to school, I think that was 49, probably. And I just really loved it. And trying to think of some of the other people that were there.
In those classes?
Mm-hmm. I remember George Beckstead and the girl that was doing the writing for the newspaper, Patty Bilfall, and she was just wonderful. And her sister was there occasionally.
And her sisters.
And she and Jack later got together on the restoration stuff.
I knew them.
And. Jean Wilfong,
mm-hmm.
and we were good friends. So that went on till they moved over there to
North Carolina. That's yeah. right.
And they're both gone now. So they were sort of one of the couples that later were sort of in our more or less social group. Bill Condon and Leland Henry and Fink and Edward Mayall. That is.
Well, talking about the social group, well, tell me about the 50s and all the fun things you all did and what Houston was like.
Yeah, well, it was a rapidly growing city. It always was from time I can remember, you know. I think they say it doubled its population every year for a long time there. But there was the Junior League where a lot of interesting things happened quickly. In college years, but and later too, the balls, a lot of things for young people as well as just the social round.
What was the art world like in Houston?
At Butte's
mm-hmm.
gallery. He was at Butte's paint store
mm-hmm.
and started this gallery in one of the back rooms because
mm-hmm.
He did the framing. You know, that's what got the art things going. I can remember that year. 49 and 50, a couple of shows that he had there that we went to.
Is that about when he first started doing it, 49 or 50?
I know that he had, I'm almost sure he'd done it while we were in school, yeah, mm-hmm. in the museum, that it was started about then. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it started much earlier or not,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed to me at the time that it was sort of a new thing. I don't know, that may be wrong, but so eventually that grew and grew, and when he was successful, other people came in, you know, and opened galleries. Some were successful and some were not. He had sort of a corner on all the local artists. And then I went away to Cranbrook in, to Michigan, 50-51. I went to the Art Students League up there and then to Cranbrook, and I was there until I graduated in 54. And so I was in and out of town on a holiday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
During those years, and there was plenty of time between the end of the summer semester till the starting of the winter session, so I still was, you know, pretty much in touch with things that were going on. And I'm thinking of Preston Bolton.
Yes.
Was president of the Every artist. Oh, I know one of the things, early things that I remember in the 50s, even earlier than that, maybe was the Contemporary Arts Museum downtown. And the first time I ever saw a real life of Van Gogh was at the show that they had, a one-man show of Van Gogh. And
This is at CAA.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The other was a column. It's a place with just a little swings, you know. And Abedin Mears was the secretary there. Abedin and her, of course, were just wonderful people, very social. We had a lot of parties that went to at their house, and informal, and, you know, just the whole gang. And Preston Frazier and was real active and everything.
Well, were you there when they moved the building over to the down? You weren't in town then. Were you, or maybe away at school?
I was away at school, but they when they took half the building out there, you know. This is one of my favorites.
We were looking at some wonderful clippings of that had been in the paper of the time when the CAA physically moved its structure from Dallas Street over to behind the Prudential Building on Holcomb. But in looking there, we were looking at some other clippings here in an exhibition of artists painting artist portraits. And here's the name of Alvin Romansky. So, Stella, you want to tell us a little bit about him?
Well, he was real active in all the things, the CAA and museum, and of course he gave that his collection of prints to the museum. And he was just a lot of fun, and he was always enjoyable, you know, to be with. And that's mostly all I can say about him. He was from an older group.
He loved art.
A lot of, yeah.
He loved art, and he was supportive of all the artists.
Yeah, he was. And so he wrote a column in some magazine. I've forgotten which one it was. I came across that the other day, but I can't say that I can put my hand on it right now. But anyway, he was real prominent and real sociable and lots of fun.
And what about Frank Zaleska?
Well, he's a real fine person. I was a godmother to his youngest child, I think. Henry Gadboy and I were godparents. It was very tragic. He died very young, as I think, spinal meningitis, something like that. And anyway, he did these small watercolors, as I remember, very colorful and all. And he got very discouraged in one point, and he went and destroyed all his work, you know. Oh. And from then on, he did mostly drawings and things, you know, and he was the put together all the shows, you know, physically and all that at the CAA
mm-hmm.
for some years. I know he worked for him when he was downtown, and he was still working for him out there at Prudential. And then he and VJ and Ruth Laird and
when you say
somebody.
When you say VJ, you mean VJ who?
VJ Tate married Frank Zaleska.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes, the Ferrari group, Preston and Addison McElroy and Sarah Mears. Here's the name I wanted to bring up. And got together and started this craft store, Handmakers.
Yes, that's come up.
And a lot of hard work. Oh, my goodness. I used to spend hours and hours in the silkscreen studio. Didn't have to go there to meetings at night, and I'd just be so tired. I couldn't think hardly. And
people love that shop, though.
Yeah. It was unique. I don't think there'd ever been one like it before, you know, with professional
artists
and stuff. And it was set up to sell our work, you know, but we could bring in other people from time to time. Mostly it was Japanese things. It was, you know, import type stuff, but we were trying to sell our own work.
Tell us more about Handmaker, Stella. Where exactly was it located?
3813 Main.
And in the basement?
In the basement. See, that was supposed to make it different, and it was. People loved going down to the basement then in Houston. You know, there weren't any shops in the basements then. And there were several gift shops across Alabama, north of us,
mm-hmm.
Main Street. And the Rudy's restaurant was upstairs.
In your building?
He started out there. Rudy's had a good business going, and we were right downstairs, so we figured we'd get business from Rudy's, which we did. You know, it helped us get going. And so we were a success in a hurry. I started to say that Mr. Gonzalez and Neve will come to me eventually. He was treasurer of Humble Oil Company, I guess, at the time. So he would come into the meetings and give us business advice, you know, and he said, well, you know, people never made a profit their first year in business. We had to plan for that and everything, and we were in the black by the end of the year.
Profit.
Not much, but, you know, we at least were
made
successful
it.
In that. I never made any money out of hardly, but anyway. Oh, dear. It was the beginning, you know, and of a...
Now, you did have occasional water in the basement.
Oh, yeah, quite a bit.
Did you have a little bit of a pump down there?
Or? Yeah, but it didn't always work, so a bunch of my fabrics were destroyed when one of the new managers put them on the floor without my knowledge. None of them was supposed to be on the floor because of the problem with the water. So,
But that was a fun time having that. It was a great opportunity for you all to have your work out there. Now, how did Handmakers... that was going on at the same time as Ben DuBose was doing his exhibitions, right?
Yeah.
And then, well, what else about Houston in the late 50s, early 60s that you can remember?
Well, one thing I remember, and I'm trying to think which year it was, but I'm so bad about numbers. Anyway, Texas Institute for Research and Rehabilitation had a real pretty little one-story hospital out in the medical center, and Mrs. McEachan mm-hmm. was one of the people who bought art for that place for a visual therapy kind of thing, mm-hmm. because so many people were bedridden and so forth, and she bought one of my paintings and put it in the nurse's station.
Oh,
and everybody liked that thing so much that the head director of the thing, the doctor, and I can't remember his name now, wanted to have it. They said, no, sir, you couldn't have it.
It had
been given to them, and that's where I was going to stay. So he talked to Ms. McEachan about it, I guess, and anyway, she knew that he wanted it, so she asked me to come and do a similar painting. The next thing was the lady in admitting wanted a painting. She liked pink, so I had to do a pink painting. And they had those flowering shrubs that they have and all down the boulevard at Galveston. I get oleanders. A lot of oleanders there and palm trees and stuff. So that was the pink painting that sort of brought the colors together that she liked, you know.
Well, Stella, you've painted. I mean, we're looking. There's different paintings in this studio. Tell us about your career as an artist and how your subject matter unfolded and developed and changed in your interests.
It wasn't until 1961 that I started teaching. The lady at the Brazosport Art League begged me to come and give classes down there. I said, "Oh, I don't teach." I don't want to teach.
I can see why they wanted you to teach.
And Lola was begging me to come start teaching at the museum. And I think Ruth Laird probably was in on that. She and I were good friends at Cranbrook. We were there at the same time. I was there longer than she was, but started sooner and everything. But she had started teaching, I think, in 58 and at the museum. A real fine potter, just beautiful work. And so they just started to wore me down. I thought, oh, well, I'll give it a try. And my first session at Brazosport was canceled because of Carla came through. I think it was Carla. And
that would be 1960 or 61. Where was Brazosport? Where was that?
That's in Freeport.
In Freeport. Mm-hmm. So you went
down
to Freeport.
I had to go every other week for 6 weeks to
teach.
And it was quite a large class and everything. So then I started in fall with a Friday night class in painting. I could have believed that I'd have a class on a Friday night, but I did.
And was that at the museum?
Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Just loved it, you know. Hadn't any idea I'd want a piece. I thought somebody should have told me this a long time ago.
Which kind of a class were you teaching?
Painting.
Just beginning painting.
But then started with that and then started teaching portrait painting and then design and special class in printmaking. I'd set up the printmaking department classes at the University of Houston the next year. They had an opening, so I started that in a broken down old Quonset hut with a floor, with a broken concrete floor, you know, throughout four
or five. So you started the printmaking at UH in the art department.
Anyway, I was teaching, sorry, double, triple time. I was teaching at Spring Branch Adult Education. Henry taught there for years and had overflow class, you know, so he recommended me. I taught there for about 3 or 4 years. Well, we finally just wore out, you know, these night classes, and had to quit. And I was teaching double time at the museum and the university. Finally, you know, I had to give up one or the other. I finally stopped teaching at the university and just taught at the museum school. So I had 6 classes then, which is more than anybody else had, and that's a lot. It was a lot of fun, and I loved being in that building. It was just wonderful, you know.
In the museum.
In the Cullen Hall. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, down in the basement, and there was the coffee room where everybody from the museum came, you know. We could just visit when we were visiting. Arden Stevens sometimes would wander down there. And I remember seeing my first, the great woman sculptor. We had 2 shows I know of. She had the black
Neville.
Mm-hmm. My favorite. Oh, gosh. Well, this was when she was in the white period, you know, mm-hmm. the first mm-hmm. one. And I was able to take my students up, you know, to these shows when I was teaching design particularly. I'd take them up and try to make them aware of the design qualities in these things. And it was wonderful teaching to. And because I was always wandering back and forth like that, you know, it was funny. I got to be where any time I'd walk in the museum, I'd be greeted by one or another the guards and stuff, you know. And I had a lot of good students there. People used to think that was just a place for untalented, rich people that didn't have anything better to do. After I got there, we started getting more serious. They'd been trying to get a certification, you know, so they could give a degree in association, I think, with the University of St. Thomas. But I kept fighting for grades. They didn't grade the students. I said, if you grade them, you know, you'll cut out the dilettantes and just get serious students.
Uh-huh.
I mean, more anyway, which we finally did after a few years. And that's the way it worked. It got better and better, I think, after that.
Well, how did the museum school progress to becoming the Glassell School that we have today? Do you remember how did it just slowly just get better, maybe, and attracted more professional artists? And
well, it had done that before I left there in 1970. I think I went to teach a year at Sam Houston, Knoxville. And we had a real good thing going by then. I think maybe we were certified by then. I can't remember when that happened. But because we had really gotten a lot of good, serious students. And we'd had a lot of students, you know, that were given the thing free.
They had scholarships.
Scholarship students.
Is this in Huntsville, you mean?
No, this was at the museum.
At the museum?
I had opened my own school after I came back from Huntsville out in the village, and I had that for 4 years till I was finally succumbed to the latest oil embargo or whatever it was at the time. And I had almost always had private classes because there were people been wanting the private classes.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly demanded it, so I'd always have some place set up to have a class. And I just kept teaching. And of course, that was the point of the school and gallery that I had in the village. And I worked so hard when I was in there. I did everything, you know. I don't know how I would have gotten along without some friends that one of my students from the museum, I know, helped me when I'd have shows and have to
hang
matting and hanging and all that kind of stuff. And I'd be up till all hours the night before finishing things up, you know. I'd done all the advertising and the layout and the mailings and the, you know, and, oh.
It's a lot of work, I know.
A lot of work. And Pete Coleman was one of the ones. He had been had a scholarship at the museum, and he was a very, very talented, good student and real nice person. I don't know what prompted him to just come by. He knew I was having a show. He'd come along on his bicycle
and help
say,
you.
Well, and he'd start doing all the hard work, you know. And the other guy was Bob Spangler. Did it.
Oh, I knew Bob.
He was a wonderful person. He just, and I never knew why either one of them did it, you know, but they were so nice to me. I just don't deserve all this, you know, but.
Bob was a nice person.
Gosh.
I remember he was a nice person.
So. He was really, really nice. One time, Bill Hoey and I were, had set up in, I think maybe had this table out in the, was it my table or somebody else? No, it was the one we had made. By the time I started teaching silk screen printing and fabric printing too at the museum. And we were printing together on some off period. I don't know if it was between semesters or something, you know, and we knew we'd be private and all. And I was working on a print that was sort of the walkway down at the Capitol building in Austin with the trees. And
yes,
It was just a small thing, but it was very colorful, though. And he used to pass back and forth and see what we were doing. And he walked over to me one time when I was about in the middle of this print. And he says, would you sell me one of those when you get through? And I said, well, yeah, sure. I said, you want to buy it? You know, I haven't even seen it finished. He says, that's all right. He says, I want it. That was a real compliment, I thought, you know, and I just really appreciated that. And
well, sure.
I think I've gotten off of the question you asked me about how.
Well, I was asking. About your art and your how you kind of the subject matter and there's just some different approaches that you've had over the years.
Yes. Well, a lot of them. I don't like to paint the same old thing all the time. You know, for instance.
Right.
I get spells where I'll do a certain thing, maybe do four or five things on the same thing, but I like to keep two or three things going at the same time because there are days when you don't have much time. You could do detail work or whatever, you know, it doesn't take your full concentration or something. And when I am low and feel bad in the old days, I would go and do silk screen. I did that at school even, you know. I worked real hard trying to develop a sort of understand the contemporary style. We had a marvelous library at Cranbrook, and I used to pore over these books, you know, Matisse and Braque and this and that and the other, all favorites of mine, both favorites of mine. And finally, you know, it just sort of gelled. One time I just kept doing these dumb things that just were nothing, but they were experiments, you know. And finally turned out a good painting. And my critic, Wally Mitchell, came by one day and said, well, I see you've been doing something. And he said, that's a beautiful painting. And so he walked out and he said, keep it up. Well, I did. And I had done a portraiture the year I first went to Cranbrook. I went to a summer semester. That was after the year arts and crafts in Detroit. Boy, I was so glad I had the opportunity to go there before I went to Cranbrook. Because in Cranbrook, you're supposed to be on your own anyway, you know. You go and work, and they give you criticism. And when I talk to my students and everything about criticism and so forth, or did, back in the old days, people always say, why do you call it criticism? I said, well, it's a critique, that's why. it's not a personal thing.
So let's keep talking a little bit about Cranbrook and of course, your experiences there. But it's interesting in our discussions about some of the artists that came to Houston who were at Cranbrook when you were at Cranbrook.
Well, I remember Hannah Stewart and
Carol
Sims, and of course David Cargill didn't come to Houston, but he's real well known in Houston. He's done a lot of work here. And
I think Carol Sims came down from with the TSU introduction, and then but Hannah was from
Alabama.
And she came, how did she come to Houston, Hannah Stewart?
Because of her friendship with Ruth Laird, I believe.
About what time would that have been? What year did you come back from Cranbrook?
I came back in 1954.
54?
After I graduated. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come back early. I stayed up for the summer with my sister and then went to New York for a couple of months. And then my introduction to New York, got to see all kinds of wonderful things all over the state and everything.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And came back to the Connecticut River Valley in October. Oh, it's just gorgeous.
Oh, how beautiful.
It really was. And we went up to Montreal and mm-hmm. Quebec. Quebec, yeah. And it was really interesting. Anyway, I came on home after that, yeah,
mm-hmm.
for Christmas. I think I was there in October and November, or September and October. I'm not real sure anymore.
Was the, now when you came back, the Art League was in gear, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I was active in that group for several years, and I entered in a lot of shows, and got a few awards here and there, and for portraits and still life and this and that. And they had the Easter Art Show in those days, not the Art League, but the Houston Post Easter Art Show. And so I was in several of those, and got the second prize one year. One of the nice things about the CAA at that time, you know, in its beginnings and all, is it was a volunteer organization, and all the people who wanted to went and volunteered and did something relative to art, whether they were artists or not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the artists got so many opportunities through that, you know, and experience. It was really wonderful. And everybody knew everybody and got friends, you know, for life from that association. And Contemporary Arts Association.
yeah, right.
And I thought that was a very unusual experience that had a lot of influence on the whole group, you know. That was really wonderful that we don't have anymore, I don't think. I mean, maybe we...
Well, did that change when Germaine McKagey started... And she was a staff person, right? She was paid.
And director. And she hired Jim Love to install the shows.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Zaleska, I think, had done most of it before there. He was employed by the museum in Erie for a number of years. And I don't know if he was replaced by Jim Love or they both did work back then, but... Of course, when they moved on, well, they took Jim Love with them, and maybe by that time we'd started Handmakers, and that was a direct result, I guess, of the CAA experience. But I was so interested in the fabric, you know. It was my minor at Cranbrook was design, and having taken a basic course in design at every school I ever went to. It was really funny. I had a really good teacher there, and I began to understand what it was all about. Not that I hadn't understood anything, but I mean, you know, I got an overall picture.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got to Cranbrook, and I loved doing silk screen. We didn't even have a teacher. We had somebody who had done it before, one of the students that got everybody together wanted to do it and gave a demonstration. Because you had to know how to use the materials to use the studio.
Now, this was at Cranbrook.
At Cranbrook.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's how we started. We just learned on our own, more or less, you know, after we got this basic idea of how to go about it. And I did a lot of work there and produced a lot of fabric and even did things on commission because everybody liked what I was doing. So
oh, fabulous.
Nice.
So, well, let's talk a minute about your output as an artist. I mean, you've worked in several different media over the years. What do you have to say about all that?
Well, I sometimes think I got too carried away with all the things like jewelry and fabric and so forth. But instead of concentrating on my painting, but it was very helpful to me when I was teaching, for instance, that I could do different things where I didn't have to put so many hours in it, as in painting and so forth, and keep up some kind mm-hmm. of output, you know, while I was teaching, because I was too tired to keep up, except in the summertime.
Wow.
And I did most of my painting and stuff in the summer, I guess, while I was teaching. And there were no contracts. You just, if you got a class, you could teach, you know, if it filled up and all that kind of thing. And they didn't pay very much, so you had to do a lot to get by. So I did everything that came my way, and I started teaching night classes out at the Spring Branch Adult Education because Henry Gadboy had been teaching there for several years and had so many students they needed to have another class, so he recommended me.
That was great.
He was very nice about those things. And got some wonderful students there. And I taught there, I think, about 3 or 4 years.
Stella, we've had a little break, and let's go back and tell me a little bit more about, in your mind's eye, the importance of the Contemporary Arts Association, CAA, that eventually became the Contemporary Arts Museum.
Well, that was going real well by the time I got back from school, but I had had introduction to it before I went away. And the first Renoir and the first Calder show I ever saw, and they were the first of that kind, I think, I heard in the country. And maybe not, maybe I've got it mixed up, but anyway, it was an early experience and saw their work. And it was set up, as I understand it, as I remember it anyway, as an volunteers, you know, that sort of did the shows. They had the ideas for the show. They got the work for the show, and they got the publicity, and they did all that stuff. They had a secretary, and they had somebody to install the show. The secretary in the beginning that I remember is Abigail Mears. She wasn't Abigail Mears then.
Yeah.
And she was there when they had the Calder and the Randolph. And Frank Deleschka was doing the installation, I think, at that time. I know he was later. And so beyond that, they sort of kept things together, see, and the rest of us, we'd have committees, you know, put on different things. And so that it was pretty well organized, but it was wonderful to come back to that and be able to join in that group of people. You didn't have to be an artist to do anything. You could just have a good idea, and if they accepted it and you put the show on, okay. And we all helped in the installation and anything we could do, you know. It was appropriate.
Uh-huh.
And I think I did my first silkscreen demonstration there. They asked me to do that, I think. And I never was so impressed. You know, I had three people helping me to do the different steps, but I had all arranged so that we had from beginning to end how to do a serigraph. And I had started it so that part of the work would be done, but they could, somebody could demonstrate how you cut a lacquer film stencil and so forth. And I don't know, it looked to me like there were 200 people there. I couldn't believe
it. Oh, my word.
There was not a seat for one of them, just the three people doing the work. I had to stand up and just, you know, holding up the stuff and explaining and all. And then just be dead silence, you know, and everybody just look and look. And it was really wonderful because they appreciated
it. They were learning.
And they understood it. And they just were so thrilled to have that. So then they started up this art collection, art rental collection, which was a very nice opportunity for people. For year after year, they'd have new paintings and stuff in the collection. Keep it moving. And so it was a selective thing. And it was real good way to show your work besides all the other shows that they had with the Houston Artist Show and the Texas Artist Show and so forth. Well, Robert Joy was given the task of getting me on the board for the Art League, and I didn't want to do it, and I kept telling him I was not capable of doing what they wanted me to do, which was be secretary. Couldn't type and all that kind of stuff. And but he paid me finally. I broke down, did it. And so I was a lousy secretary. Anyway, I was in a lot of shows there, and at that time,